Hello, I'm Maya Bloomberg. Thank you for joining us for a new CME Outfitters snack series titled Health Equity in the Context of New and Emerging Therapies for Hemophilia. This initiative is supported by an educational grant from Novo Nordisk Incorporated. This is the first of two CMEO snacks and will address the question, does labeling the level of severity in hemophilia block access to optimized care? Again, I'm Maya Bloomberg. I'm a hematology nurse practitioner specializing in congenital bleeding disorders and sickle cell. And for the past 10 years, I've been the adult nurse coordinator at the University of Miami Hemophilia Treatment Center. I am very pleased to be joined today by Dr. Guy Young, who I'll ask to introduce himself. Welcome, Dr. Young.
Good morning. Good morning, Maya. So my name is Guy Young, as you heard. I'm the director of the Hemostasis and Thrombosis Center at Children's Hospital, Los Angeles, and a professor of pediatrics at the University of Southern California Keck School of Medicine in Los Angeles as well. And I'm pleased to be here with you to discuss really an important issue that I think has long been ignored.
Thank you. I'm looking forward to it also. Here is our learning objective for today's activity. After participating in this activity, learners should be able to provide equitable care for all patients with hemophilia, including those from underserved communities and those who don't meet formal severity thresholds for prophylaxis yet experience significant bleeds. In a moment, we're going to introduce a patient case, but first, Dr. Young, perhaps you can walk us through the therapeutic evolution we've seen in hemophilia, especially the developments over the past decade or so.
Yes, certainly. I mean, if we go back, 100 years, patients with hemophilia rarely survived past the age of 20. And yet here we are 100 years later, where we have treatments that, are really, almost the realm of what would have been considered science fiction many years ago in terms of gene therapy. I'd say the first real advance was in the 1970s when clotting factor concentrates became available and allowed for home treatment. This essentially disengaged patients from having to be tied to the hospital and be hospitalized for prolonged periods of time. Unfortunately, those products led to a catastrophe with respect to viral infections in our community of patients. But since then, plasma-derived products have become much safer. And moreover, we've moved really to recombinant products, which is what came along in the 1990s. So recombinant clotting factor concentrates were really, for about 25, almost 30 years, the only treatment that we had. And they worked really quite well. But the downside is that they had to be given intravenously and often multiple times per week to prevent bleeding. And this, of course, created a large treatment burden, often required central venous catheters in children, and led to poor treatment adherence, particularly in adolescents and adults. And that brought us to the next era, which is really fairly new, which is the non-factor therapy era. And emicizumab is the one drug we currently have available for that, although many other drugs are going to become available in the coming years, including probably several in the US within the next year. The advantage of non-factor therapies is that they're given subcutaneously. And so that significantly reduces the treatment burden, and to the extent that we can tell so far, also improves adherence. And then, even most recently, we've hit the next frontier, which is gene therapy. And gene therapies are essentially a one-time treatment with the goal of correcting the factor deficiency to at least a level that is effective at preventing bleeding. And thereby, patients do not need to infuse, and hopefully, in most cases, don't bleed. And those gene therapies that are on the market now, while are not perfect, certainly do offer another avenue of treatment for patients who are looking to have the least or essentially no treatment burden. So that's where we are now. But there's a lot in the pipeline and a lot to look forward to in the next 2 to 3, and certainly 5 to 10 years of novel treatments that are coming in hemophilia.
Thank you so much for that. It's been really exciting just watching the evolution and seeing our treatment landscape rapidly evolve. Now, I would be remiss if I didn't address this slide, which really speaks to what new therapies can mean to people with hemophilia. This path really emphasizes that improving patient quality of life through better bleed protection will lead to broader participation in just everyday activities and ultimately reaching a state of optimal health and well-being. When we think about hypertension and diabetes, we always treat to normal levels. And for so long, we've accepted that 1 to 3 trough level. But with these advancements in technologies and treatment options, we really are getting closer to that functional cure and achieving health equity. So I think now is a good time for us to dive into our patient case. So, Dr. Young, please tell us a little bit about Lucas.
Sure. Lucas is a 4-year-old black male with mild hemophilia A, so 5%, which is really at the lowest end of mild hemophilia A. And for those who are still learning about hemophilia, just understand that the classification of hemophilia A in terms of severe, moderate, and mild, those terms are specifically tied in to the factor level at baseline. They are not reflecting the clinical scenario necessarily. So severe is less than 1% or essentially undetectable levels of factor. That could be factor 8 or factor 9, although today we're talking about hemophilia A with factor 8. Moderate hemophilia is 1 to up to 5% of normal residual factor levels, and mild is 5 to 40%. In severe hemophilia A, spontaneous bleeding is the hallmark, and bleeding into joints and muscles. And patients typically will present in the first year, if not even in the first days or weeks of life. In moderate hemophilia A, if there's no family history and testing isn't done early in life, it could be diagnosed a bit later in life, but typically not past about the age of 2 or 3, due to also spontaneous events and quite a bit of bleeding that can occur with very minor trauma. In mild hemophilia, we typically think that bleeding occurs only with trauma. Spontaneous bleeding is uncommon. But when we say trauma, I mean there are traumas every single day of walking up the steps and taking a slight little slip, things that those of us without hemophilia don't think about. But even those relatively small traumas, right? We're not talking about, falling down a flight of stairs, but just a small little slip is enough in cases of mild hemophilia, particularly at 5%, to trigger a joint bleed. So in this case, Lucas presents with a significant bleed in his ankle following a minor trauma that required pain medication as well as hospitalization for 2 days. And the reason he was hospitalized is because often patients with mild hemophilia don't have the capacity to dose themselves at home. And in fact, this was Lucas's first bleed. And so the family even had a hard time initially recognizing the symptoms, which is another situation that happens with mild hemophilia. Again, the parents didn't notice a specific trauma, but Lucas was playing with his usual playtime activities, ones that the family considers safe, and that somehow through that activity, he must have had an injury or some sort of minor trauma that led to this ankle bleed.
So I think this is a really great case because we know that the standard of care for hemophilia is the use of prophylaxis, but the guidelines are definitely less clear when it comes to treating individuals with mild or moderate hemophilia. So with this patient, it was his first bleed. He had to get hospitalized for it. He required pain medication and whatnot. So can you walk us through what was going through your minds when managing this patient? Did you keep him on demand after this bleed, or did you even have that discussion with prophylaxis?
Yes. So I think with any kind of bleed that requires hospitalization, a significant joint bleed, we do need to talk about what that means for the future going forward. And even though a patient has mild hemophilia, I think sometimes that term can be misconstrued. And I stated before that these categorizations are essentially so we can communicate well with each other about what we mean by a patient with severe, moderate, and mild. And they only reflect the baseline factor level. There are patients with mild hemophilia who bleed quite frequently. And starting with this kind of severe bleed at a pretty young age of 5 is one that portends for future bleeds for Lucas. And I did talk to the family about the consideration for prophylaxis even after this one bleed. And really that becomes the question, right? Is it okay to allow Lucas to remain on-demand therapy after this one bleed? And I think, we don't really know yet the answer to that. But I think the goalposts are moving. In the past, it wouldn't even be a consideration. It would be to say, okay, you had this bleed, you had a little trauma. Okay, go home. We're not going to put you on prophylaxis, so we're not even going to think about it. And that, if there's another bleed at some point in the future, yeah, maybe we'll talk about it then, but probably necessary, but probably not, or not necessarily. I think, as I say, the goalposts are moving. Some of that is because of the new treatments that I mentioned. To start, a 5-year-old on, let's say, a 3 times a week IV factor prophylaxis treatment, as would have been the case as little as 10 years ago, for this one bleed, would be a huge treatment burden for the family to undertake when it's not even clear whether he'll have another bleed in the future. But with new treatments that reduce the frequency of the IV injections to twice a week or even once a week or potentially even less often, as well as non-factor therapies that are subcutaneous, really lowers the bar to entry for prophylaxis, which is a term I've been using, as treatments become easier and easier to give. And as they become better and better at preventing bleeding, we really do need to start asking ourselves the question of which patients with hemophilia actually should not be on prophylaxis, as opposed to asking the question which patients should be on prophylaxis. And so there are no real guidelines that will provide a cookbook answer in this case. I think we have to talk to the patient's parents about their specific situation. What are their values? What are their concerns? Are they really proactively seeking bleed prevention? Are they more going to take a wait and see approach? That's where shared decision making comes in, which has been a big buzzword the last few years. And it is a buzzword because as we have more treatments and better treatments, we have to offer those different options to families because they all have different potential properties. So in this case, we decided to wait on starting prophylaxis, but we did discuss that even if there's one more bleed in the near future or even in the further future, that probably after that we would start prophylaxis.
Yeah, I think there's so much more that goes into treatment decisions and deciding prophylaxis or on demand, and so much more beyond just your factor level, like you said, because you have to take into account the actual bleeding phenotype. Because I have patients with moderate hemophilia who bleed like a severe, we want to take into account their activity level, their joint health. Maybe this is a time that we can kind of touch on just the vicious cycle of how just one bleeding episode can kind of start that cycle of hemophilic arthropathy. Do you want to touch a little bit on that?
Yes, certainly. And in fact, it would not be unusual for this bleed that required 2 days of hospitalization to set off this vicious cycle, where he may, with another minor trauma in a week or two, rebleed in that ankle. And what happens is once you have blood in the joint, it activates the inflammatory system locally, and you can get inflammation within the joint, which then leads to synovial hypertrophy. The synovium is the lining of the blood vessel, which is typically just a sort of a thin film, essentially, that basically encapsulates the joints and contains the synovial fluid, which is really the lubricant for the joints. Once there's inflammation in there, synovial hypertrophy, so a increase in the growth of cells in that lining, that then lead to these finger-like projections, which you can actually see on arthroscopy if you ever look inside one of these joints. And then those finger-like projections just become more prone to bleeding. They're very vascular. So it takes even less trauma to lead to a second bleed, which then leads to more inflammation and then more synovial hypertrophy. And that's how you enter this vicious circle that results in a target joint, essentially a joint that bleeds over and over again. And those are the joints that become permanently damaged. And certainly we want to prevent that here. And in fact, only one severe joint bleed can set that cycle up.
Exactly. So this is why we're, I think, again, this is an amazing case to highlight because it is somebody with mild, granted the low end of mild at 5%, but he did have a pretty bad bleed where, given the treatment options we do have, it wouldn't be unreasonable to start prophylaxis. Because, like you mentioned, 5 or 10 plus years ago, when we only had the factor replacement and 3 times a week is the general dosing for the standard half-life products for prophylaxis, that would be a huge treatment burden for a family and a young child. But with the novel therapies and the subcutaneous options, it's definitely easier to start patients on prophylaxis. And I think we are going to start seeing a shift, like when we talk about health equity and functional cures and just allowing our patients to live their life without having to overthink or second guess their hemophilia. My prediction is in the next 10 years, with all of these growing treatment options and whatnot, we're going to start seeing mild and moderate maybe become a standard of care to be on prophylaxis to help reduce that morbidity of hemophilic arthropathy, which is again the number one cause of morbidity and complications and leads to chronic pain. So anything we can do to prevent that would obviously be optimal. So I think this is a good segue into another very important topic in hemophilia, which is equitable care. Now, the CDC defines health equity as the state in which everyone has just a fair and just opportunity to attain their highest level of health. Now, there's a difference between equality and equity. Equality is when we're treating everyone the same and we're providing the same resources and opportunities, while equity recognizes that different people ultimately have different circumstances and allocates the resources and whatnot to reach an equal outcome, and really focuses on the fairness and equal outcomes by addressing specific needs and barriers. We then have our health disparities, which are the result of health inequities. And these are the preventable differences in health status of one population or one individual compared to another. And it's the result of the social, economical, and environmental disadvantages, really the result of an individual's social determinants of health. Now, we can't talk about health equity without addressing social determinants of health because there's so many things that really play a part in our health outcomes. And the social determinants of health are the conditions that we are born and grow and work, and those wider systems that shape conditions of everyday life. And they influence disparities by influencing access to healthcare, health literacy, influencing our health behaviors. And we know that 40% of an individual's social and economic factors influence health outcomes, which includes things like income and housing stability and access to transportation, all of which can affect somebody's ability to adhere to specific treatment regimens. Now, specifically to hemophilia, there are known racial disparities. So I'll go over some of these and then maybe we can talk about Lucas a little bit more and just some considerations from that standpoint. But we have data confirming that people of color are less likely to receive prophylaxis or be on home therapy compared to white patients. We know that there's a disparity where Black and Hispanics are twice as likely to develop inhibitors despite having similar genetic mutations. And I think the one that stood out to me most when I read this article is that despite similar levels of adherence to treatment, people of color report higher levels of chronic pain and lower quality of life. But the take-home message is that it's not due to biology, it's influenced just by the systemic racism and really emphasizing the importance of addressing social determinants of health to bring health equity to our patients. Because if we're just thinking about hemophilia alone and treating the disease, we're missing a mark. Because even with the novel treatments, if we want to talk about health literacy, there's so much more education and teaching that goes into starting a patient on a novel treatment as opposed to factor therapy. Because if I have an individual who isn't understanding that novel therapies or the non-factor therapies are only for prophylaxis and they need a second product to treat a breakthrough bleed or for surgical management, that might give me a little pause and see, is this a safe therapy for this patient? Because I don't want them to put themselves in undue harm for per se. Do you ever have difficulties, or do you find yourself making treatment decisions based on the health literacy, or do you find that that's more just you're spending more time to teach and reinforce information and make sure that they verbalize understanding before going home with a certain therapy?
Yes, Maya. No, those are also such important points. I think one comment first on the equity versus equality is that equality would be taking every patient with mild hemophilia and saying, you don't need to be on prophylaxis. Whereas equity would be identifying those with mild hemophilia who do have a bleeding phenotype and saying, no, we need to start prophylaxis for you. So I think that's a good example of equality versus equity when it comes to situations of hemophilia, where sometimes we just paint everybody with a broad brush. You're severe, you're on prophy, you're mild, you're not on prophy. And we really need to think about that in more detail. When it comes to the health literacy aspect of it, it is very challenging. And I think the challenge for us as physicians, nurse practitioners, other allied healthcare providers, is we need to understand our patients' background. And we need to understand these kind of issues of racial and ethnic disparities so that we can bring the equity into our conversation. The conversation I might have with one family who is, let's say, wealthy, white, and highly educated with doctors in the family about a new treatment would necessarily have to be different if I'm talking to a family that has less education, no healthcare providers in the family, less general understanding of medicine, and perhaps due to their experiences, less trustworthiness of the physician or of the healthcare team or just of healthcare in general. So you need to really understand, where your patients are coming from. And I just don't mean like what town they're coming from or what street they live on, but what is their background? What is their experience, in the field of healthcare and dealing with healthcare and probably having dealt with healthcare disparities before. And you might need to spend more time with them. You might need to explain things differently to them. And I think that we all have to learn really how to do that well. Because at the end of the day, what equity would mean is that one family who may have a different set of circumstances leaving my clinic and another family that has a completely other set of circumstances truly understand the options that they were each offered and can help make an informed decision along with the healthcare team. And yes, that's a big challenge, but I mean, we are all invested in the best care for our patients, regardless of background. And I think I often say this when I talk about hemophilia, in that it is kind of the ultimate democratic disease in a way, because, and I say that because it does not have an ethnic predilection, does not have a racial predilection. Basically, anybody can be affected with hemophilia of any race, of any origin, nationality, ancestry. It doesn't care if you're rich or poor, doesn't care if you're Republican or Democrat. It really affects the community equally. And so that means that we're going to have various layers and members of society who are going to suffer from hemophilia. And we need to be prepared to talk to each one of them in a way that they can A, understand what you're saying, and B, build that trust in you so that you together can make the best decisions for them.
And I think it also ultimately emphasizes the importance of being followed at a comprehensive hemophilia treatment center because we have so many different points of contact at that visit. And I might describe something differently than the hematologist or maybe differently than our physical therapist. So you have different people who are able to reinforce information and get information out to make sure patients are getting what they need. And one of the most important is really just having that social worker who can perform that psychosocial assessment and really hit on every single type of economical housing, financial security, et cetera, to identify what barriers might prevent somebody or prevent an individual from achieving optimal health outcomes.
Absolutely, totally agree with that.
Now, we touched on it, or you touched on it briefly with regards to where shared decision making has kind of become a hot topic. And it's really because we've had so many treatment options pop up that is making decision making so much more complex. And it involves that two-way dialogue where patients and caregivers are truly becoming a partner in the decision making, where patients have the opportunity to share what their treatment goals are and what matters most to them out of treatments. Then, as providers, we are the one who present that there is actually a choice existing and then review all of the different options. And together, we're coming to a decision what the best course of action is, because Not all patients want, even though in our minds, subcutaneous is much more convenient, not everybody wants to potentially require a second product if they're having a breakthrough bleed or if they're having surgical procedure. Some patients want an all-in-one product like factor replacement. But then we also have to take into account where do these individuals live, because maybe being on a subcutaneous therapy allows a little bit more freedom, especially if you don't live as close to a hemophilia treatment center, or maybe you don't have access to a home health care agency to perform the factor infusions. Because of with the mild and moderates, you had mentioned that they didn't detect the bleed, because if you're not bleeding as frequently, you might not have that insight very early on. But you mentioned with your patient that you ultimately utilize shared decision making in order to come to the decision, because it wasn't a clear-cut case for should we continue on demand or should we consider prophylaxis. There's plenty of reasons why prophylaxis might have been considered for lupus, just understanding how one bad bleed can start that cycle of hemophilic arthropathy. And we do have options that allow subcutaneous injections. We don't have to get the ports placed anymore. But ultimately, you had that two-way dialogue and listened to the family and what was important for them, and ultimately decided to do a wait-and-see approach, which is appropriate. There's no, it's not black and white when it comes to hemophilia management. So it really does involve taking into account treatment goals and what matters most to our patients. Do you find at your center you're the one who are guiding more of these dialogues, or how does it work with regards to your nurse practitioners and other staff?
Yeah, I think you made some really good points about first making sure patients get their care in a hemophilia treatment center. Your point about the fact that each hemophilia treatment center has a multidisciplinary team that all meets with the patients, and that each individual on the team brings their own perspectives to discuss with the family is really, really critical. It's amazing to me that as many years as I've been practicing, which is 25 at this point, that sometimes the physical therapist will come out of a room and give me an insight that after 20, 30 minutes of me being in the room, I didn't get.
It's
And
happened
this
all the
happens
time
with,
to me.
absolutely. And this happens with the physical therapist. It happens with the social worker sometimes, depending on what the particular situation might be, or the nurse practitioner. So, I mean, my philosophy is I empower each of the members of the team. That they're an equal partner in making the best decisions for the patients, that we as a team will come together and help make the best decisions for that patient, along, of course, with the partnership of the patient or the parents of the patient. And we need to understand that, just like, the regular parts of society, patients are part of regular society. In other words, their patients who are very conservative in their medical views. There are those who are more risk averse. There's those who are more willing to take risks. There are those who are very active in the decision making. There are those who are more passive. And that just reflects, the nature of our society in general. And so I think we work together with the patients. I fully empower the nurse practitioners on the team. They're essentially the front line for most of our patients to discuss with patients to make decisions. They certainly can come to the physicians and me in particular if there's questions. But I like to empower every member of the healthcare team to engage in whatever conversation they feel like they need to have with the patient, and then we can come together as a team along with the patient and or the parents of the patient, and really make a decision that I know when that patient leaves that for that day, that was the right decision. And that when they come back, we'll have another conversation and the decision at that point could change. But really, it's about empowering your team to have the right conversation with the patients so that everyone walks away feeling very confident that today's decision was the right one.
Well, I think that's about all the time we have today. So I'd like to thank you, Dr. Young, for joining us and sharing your insights. And thank you to our audience for participating. By way of summary, I'd like to offer a few SMART goals, which are specific, measurable, attainable, relevant, and timely action items you can apply to the care of patients in your own practice. So the first one is just considering prophylaxis based on an individual patient and their bleeding episodes, not necessarily restricting it based on that severity category. It's also important to stay current with new and emerging therapeutic options for hemophilia. Dr. Young mentioned we were going to have an explosion in the next couple of years with a lot of other non-factor therapy agents coming out. So just make sure you're staying up to date with the conferences and clinical literature and medical research with regards to that. And lastly, we want you to take steps to ensure equitable care is provided to all patients. So again, this is assessing and also addressing the social determinants of health, engaging in shared decision making, and really just working with patients and families to access optimal care. Again, thank you, Dr. Young, for today's discussions. As I mentioned, this is the first of two new CMEO snacks on hemophilia. In the next program, I'll be joined by Dr. Tammy Crescenteri Singleton, a renowned authority on both hemophilia and issues of equitable care. And we'll be taking a deeper dive into the racial and ethnic disparities we see in hemophilia and just ways to improve quality of care and outcomes for all people with hemophilia. Thank you so much.